Welcome to the Race to Rugby World Cup pod with Ron and Adam from the side of the road, somewhere on the planet.
Race to Rugby World Cup pod is back on the road. We are recording our first on the road podcast here in Japan. Previously, we did a couple episodes in South Africa and Namibia, but this is a dedicated Ron and Adam show. So bear with us.
Please don't tune out yet.
For the next 40 minutes. But I think it's going to be a special episode. We've got about 10 days worth of catching up to do with everyone who's listening and explain to you how our route has been and our journey so far. But I'll just kickstart just maybe the before and then we'll get into day one. So the last time we spoke, we gave you a route explained of our journey that we plan to do over the next 200 and so days when we launched it. But yeah, we officially arrived in Japan. And it was quite a strenuous travel experience with all the COVID regulations that were coming in. You know, we all agreed on them and we signed up for it. So it wasn't like it shocked us. However, we did expect no quarantine. If we are triple vaccinated and from South Africa, we could just kind of go straight into it. But we got wind that someone on our flight tested positive for COVID after landing and we had to go into a quarantine. Where we found quite a cool little spot. We had our two futons, a little balcony. It was cramped, but you know we agreed to it. We were focused on the mission at hand, which is delivering the Rugby World Cup whistle. And yeah, we got through the quarantine and made it to day one.
Yeah, and I think just to get a bit of context as well, I mean, obviously the effort in getting to Japan was enormous. And Japan Rugby and DHL like bent over backwards to get us these special visas, which allowed us into the country as part of a Rugby World Cup campaign, sort of following on from the 2019 efforts. So it was enormous relief just to get those visas and to be on the flights to Japan. And once we had those visas in hand and had our flights booked, we obviously booked. We agreed a certain start date, which was Friday, off the top of my head, I think the 9th of March. Which gave us sort of 3 days in Tokyo to get organized and then start the ride. And Fumi at Japan Rugby had bent over backwards to organize the stadium, the Tokyo Stadium, to get everything ready for us. And then when we got messages about it, it was disappointing for us, obviously, having to then do this unexpected quarantine. But I think just shout out to Japan Rugby for the effort they did then to move our start date a couple of days later to accommodate this quarantine.
Yeah, and it feels quite strange. You know, there's no tourists in Japan at the moment. So, you know, we do look very touristy. We are, yeah, on a business visa. We are representing DHL and World Rugby. So we do get a couple's wide eyes. We actually, right now, we're sitting at a tourist destination at Awiji Island, just kind of overlooking this resort. We spent the night in an auto camp. Area, so also quite funny. Everyone's got their RVs, and we roll up there with our bicycles in the little section. But it's pretty cool. But yeah, just to show how much effort they put in, we are essentially the only inverted comma tourists in the country at the moment.
Yeah, so it was. Yeah, we feel very lucky, and you know how important it is for us to have started in Japan. And you know, there's other countries you might have to skip. For example, China. We spoke about that in our route planning. That we prepared to skip, you know, under these quarantine and this COVID regulation world that we live in. But Japan was just too important for us. And it's always, as we've always said to ourselves, there's always a way. So here we are. We got through the quarantine. We got through the little bit of initial delay. But my goodness, wasn't it good to get to that start line in Tokyo Stadium?
Exactly. And that was the most important thing. That's where you delivered the whistle in 2019. So like that day was pretty special. It's a massive stadium. I love going into stadiums. It's very well kept. It's not, no offense to some of the South African stadiums, but everything's super neat. You couldn't even touch the grass. Yeah. There was a lot of like regulations getting in and out, but wow, it was amazing.
Yeah, I must say to have Remji, which are the two mascots from 2019 there, some of Sakura 15, which are the women's Japanese team players there, representative obviously of DHL, of the media, of Japan Rugby. And of course, and even Lipo D, the sort of the energy drink company as well represented. So we
followed a ton of journalists.
A ton of media and journalists. And I must say, everybody really went to an effort to make us feel very special. And I think for me, definitely, and just speaking for myself, it sort of gave us a realization that we are on, you know, there's a lot of people behind us and supporting us. And we've kind of taken on this big important responsibility of delivering the whistle and going out there to raise funds for Child Fund. And it really hit home that we're on the road now. This is a start. People have supported us. People have backed us. Now it's our turn to deliver.
Yeah. So we cruised out of the stadium after a really awesome handover. And we only set out to do about 25 kilometers on that first day because we actually were only allowed into the stadium that afternoon. And we headed towards south, but like basically still in Tokyo. And we headed towards a guy called James. We found him on the Warm Showers app. James McGee's an absolute legend. He opened his home to us on that first night, and we actually met up with Koichi and Hyperman that evening. And we, you know, it was a chilled out cycle. Got into the home, walked to a local restaurant and enjoyed a meal. But that highlight that evening was meeting this guy, James, an American. He's working for the US military here. And what an awesome guy. He's just been so helpful.
Yeah, he's obviously traveled the world, seen the world. He's explored Japan extensively on a bicycle. So and a reservoir of knowledge, local knowledge. He speaks very, very good Japanese. So and subsequent to that visit, you know, he keeps on messaging us every day. What can he do? What can he do? And he's asking the wrong people because we keep on taking him up on the offer to help sort stuff out. He's got a proper setup at home in terms of he's built two bikes from scratch from the ground up
with roll-off hubs, which is quite cool.
Which is very, very
first
cool.
First time we've seen roll-off hubs outside of our own bikes.
Yeah, so he was very. Yeah, I think he was chuffed to see that as well. And I think it was a really. Yeah, I mean, for us, that, as you say, that evening was really special just to be able to go out, have a quiet drink, have a nice local meal in one of the restaurants and just sort of take a deep breath because it had been a full-on day. You know, it'd been a lot of attention and a lot of focus, a lot of interviews, and it's all very, very nice. But it was also nice just to be able to take a deep breath and just sort of cheers each other that we actually got to the most important step of the journey, which was day one.
Yeah. And the next morning we headed out and we basically decided to do a cycle tour. We did 110 kilometers, but it was quite exciting because it was clear skies that day and Mount Fuji was glistening. There was still snow on the top. So the whole day, you basically, wherever you looked, you had Mount Fuji in your sights. But we also had like a couple like, I wouldn't say scary, but like quite hectic tunnel passes that we had to go through. There's not really a big gap for the size bikes we have and big trucks coming by. But we also had a bit of a wake-up call because from not cycling for a month to doing basically a mini cycle tour of 110 kilometers, we started feeling it in our legs.
Yeah, I think our 6 weeks, neither of us rode 1 kilometer in the 6 weeks between Windhoek and the start of Japan. I, for one, fattened up properly. So it was a real test. And I think as well, you know, we were just going back to the Mount Fuji thing, you know, it holds a very special place in Japan, in the Japan culture and with Japanese people. And you can almost see why. I mean, it just dominates the skyline. It's the most impressive, you know, and it really does take your breath away. And just to have it, to be cycling on the most incredible spring day, it was really, 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 really special. But as I say, a long day in the legs. And I think we didn't realize it at the time, but you know, my pedals had started getting a little bit tighter. So there was some sort of issue with it turned out to be the bottom bracket. But we also had a little bit of pressure because the next day we had a target to get to reach. So it wasn't like on day two we could just sort of put our feet up and call it quits after 60 Ks.
Yeah, we had to get to Ekopa Stadium, which is somewhat special to me. In 2002, I was a soccer fan, like fanatic. I had all the books and info and... Japan, South Korea hosted the 2002 FIFA World Cup. And so in 2002, I kind of started recognizing and remembering all the different stadiums around. And to see one of them that I just had like a little sticker book icon of in real life was quite special. It also hosted the 2019 rugby fixture where Ireland played Japan. And famously beat Ireland to top their pool. And funny enough, it's also the stadium that was the home base for the Irish Olympic team during the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. So very cool. There was a lot of journalists there. There were a couple of the local teams. And actually, we got to go and see the Sakura 15 training camp that was happening behind the stadium. You know, couldn't get too close or chat to them because of the COVID bubble that they had, but it was quite an awesome day. So hurt our legs. We really did have to push. It was a 95-kilometer cycle from start to Ikopa, and Ron's bike was just deteriorating slowly but surely. But when we got there, it was worth it.
I think we have forgotten one of the most important things about the day was that climb that we had to do.
Yes.
Pushing our bike about 1.5 kilometers. I think we climbed about 200 meters and 1.5 kilometers, literally.
Yeah.
In my 60,000 K, 100 country, 3 or 4 year life on a bicycle, I've never had a hill like that. And there we are, just a sort of random hill between the green tea fields on the way to Copper Stadium. So under pressure already from a timing point of view. My bike was struggling. I was struggling with my legs, certainly from being unfit. And then we had to deal with pushing our bikes up this, yeah, up this hill.
It should be stairs. That's how steep.
It should be banned.
Yeah, it's not. It shouldn't be a cycle road. There was another guy who's just traveling around as well, and he was pushing his bike up as well, so we didn't feel guilty. It was just the steepest thing, and even just pushing your bike up, you used an extreme amount of energy,
especially when the bike weighs 40 kilos.
Yeah, so. But yeah, then after Copper Stadium and having a great send off and saying goodbye to our dear friend Koichi from DHL, who's been helping us out, we actually had to do an extra 25 kilometers from about 4 p.m. to get to Hamamatsu, where there was a bicycle shop that we would rather send Ron's bike to get checked there than us fiddling with it on the side of the road with potentially not the correct
tools
and potentially not the correct spare parts, which was a good call. So yeah, we actually had to...
It's day of deadlines. I mean, we arrived, yeah. We were supposed to get to a cop at 3 o'clock. I think we arrived at 1 minute to 3. Mm. The bike shop closed at 7. I think we arrived at 10 to 7.
Yeah.
And hats off to them. They were amazing. I mean, they welcomed us in at 6:45. The mechanics sort of had a good look at it, took the BBR off, and it was a complete wreck. The ball bearings, yeah, were sort of, you know, just had disintegrated. So how that happened, I still don't know. We don't have any good theories on it.
There was the theory. So yeah, in Japan, a lot of the pedestrian crossings, when you go from the sidewalk over a road and back to a sidewalk, there's these steep-edged, like, I don't know what it's called, but the steeper edges. So it's not smooth. When you're riding on a bike lane and you're crossing a road, you go like, doo-doo. And, you know, if we've got about 35 kilograms of kit on the back wheel plus our bodies. And so if we're going at a decent speed, I'd say a little bit more than like 30 kilometers an hour on a slight downhill, and you hit those, standing on your pedals – or crank, like, it might cause a bit of tension. That's the only theory I have, because, you know, the BBs are pretty new.
They've got a couple of thousand.
Yeah, they shouldn't have damaged. Maybe some dirt or something got in there. I don't know. But that's the only theory we have. And we are a little bit more cautious crossing roads now. But yeah, it is the one downfall of cycling in Japan, is the stop-start nature of those crossings. But yeah, it's still pretty cool.
Yeah, I think we spoke about it before, but I think just the first 20 kilometers out of Tokyo, we did more turns than we did from the whole of Cape Town to Windhoek.
Yes.
And definitely more traffic lights. You do get these long stretches of roads. And I mean, I must say, from a cycling point of view, it's one of the few countries in the world where pedestrians and cyclists share pavements without any conflict or seemingly conflict.
Yes.
Everyone's very respectful of each other's distances. But everyone's also very respectful of the rules. So you sort of get to these red lights and everybody diligently sits
there's nothing
going on. So every now and then you might sneak across one, maybe a couple of seconds early before it goes green, and you do feel somewhat guilty.
To rest our legs on day 4, we had to take a day off. We actually had to order a new BB. We did have spares, but we didn't think we'd need to use them so soon. So we actually stored them a little bit ahead.
But shout out to James McGee again.
Yeah. And yeah, James McGee, host from day one, he sourced a BB that will fit the bike. And at the moment with COVID, or I don't know how it works, but shops only open from 11 a.m. and they close at 7 p.m. So frustratingly, we had to wait till 11 to really like process anything. And once that happened, then they were going to send a BB to us, but then that takes overnight and it would only arrive past 11 the next day. So, you know, we just said, okay, we actually do need to rest our legs. They were feeling horrifically painful. Yeah. And yeah, we took the day off in Hamamatsu, caught up on all of the, you know, the PR stuff that came out on departure day, which wasn't too bad. It was a nice rest. It was actually good weather. I walked to the beach, and we just patiently waited for that part. And It got sent to Bicycle Watanabe, and the mechanics there are legends. And they put it together for us before about 2 p.m. the following day. So that would be day 5 of our adventure. And Ron and I were itching to get cycling again. We knew it was an afternoon ride. We just committed. We said, let's just do 25 to 30. And yeah, we made our way to the lake, Hamana Lake, Lake Hamana, and just started scouting little camping spots.
Yeah, and it was getting quite dark in the evening, and the drizzle was coming down. But it was very, very cool ride. I mean, just spending kilometers and kilometers along the lake edge. And again, to your point about just wanting to get going, I mean, the easy option, I guess, would have just been to stay another night in Amatsu and say, let's start tomorrow morning. But as always, you make a decision to ride, you never, ever regret it. Mm. Although at the time when your fingers start getting cold and your toes start getting cold, you start wondering whether that's very sensible. But just as it was starting to get almost too dark to find somewhere to camp, we stumbled across this sort of section of the lake, which was pretty quiet and remote. And obviously in the summer, you could just imagine how it'd be buzzing, sort of like Cape Town promenade life, yeah, with people renting out kayaks and boats. And you could just imagine it just being a hive of activity. But at this time of year, there's absolutely nothing going on. A lot of shops are boarded up. Hotels look like they need a coat of paint before the new season. And then we stumbled upon cool people.
It's called Tea Flow, what caught our eye is it says good people.
Good people, yes.
Just like a big billboard, good people on the grass, and it was like you can imagine like an old surf shack. It was really cool, very neat, you know, good woodwork everywhere, yeah. And it was obviously abandoned because it was freezing cold and off season. And that's where we decided to make home for the night.
Yeah, one of the nice shelters with some furniture that they packed away for the winter. And we sort of managed to shift the furniture around with keeping it undercover. And it made for the perfect place to pitch our tent. It wasn't the warmest of nights, but we did have shelter, and it gave us a chance to, you know, unpack our stuff and hang it up and dry it. And I woke up the next morning to the most wonderful, I wouldn't say sunrise, but certainly, yeah, blue sky and
calm
sky.
Calm lake. There were birds flying all over the place. Yeah. We set up our jet boil, made our first on-the-road cup of coffee. The adventure kind of started. You know, every time we got more remote, it just makes you feel more excited about touring. We kick-started that day, which was quite exciting. We just start, you know, at this point, it was like, let's just go until, you know, we kind of need a place to stay. And we were cycling, and next thing we stumbled across a rugby day in Okazaki. Yeah. There's about four teams, under 10s to under 12s, just jolling. And we're like, we got to go and watch.
Yeah, this is Saturday morning.
So yeah, Saturday morning, and we rolled in there, and one of the refs or coaches were like, they're just kind of pointing at us saying, New Zealand, New Zealand. And like, yes, yeah, we're taking the whistle to New Zealand. Next thing, everyone's phones are out. We're getting selfies with everyone. We had to pull out the ball. We pulled out the whistle, and it was amazing. That whole community understood exactly what we were doing. Yeah. They've obviously seen the posts in the media. And yeah, it gave us such motivation.
Yeah, that whistle certainly does help with the confidence. All of a sudden, there's sort of the center of attention. But it really is a wonderful symbol of the journey. And it's nice to know that in the rugby community here in Japan, people have picked up on it. And, you know, every now and then we get people waving at us and hooting us. And they've obviously seen the sort of stories in the local news. So it's nice that the stories got out and that people make the connection between Japan and New Zealand and the Women's World Cup. And that under 10 or under 12 rugby that we watched Saturday morning, just like anywhere else in the world, whether you're in South Africa or the UK or Australia or New Zealand or Wales or Italy, wherever rugby's played, young children running around on a muddy, just diving about, getting themselves, just having the time of their lives, parents volunteering as coaches and referees. And it really is just just the spirit of the game of rugby. And there's girls playing in the team, so that age here, they don't seem to differentiate, which is very, very cool. So the sisters that want to get involved are welcome to. And it really was just like, this is so cool. This could be anywhere in the world.
Yeah, it was very cool. I actually honestly loved it. It was one of the highlights of this trip so far. But yeah, we packed up there. We actually stayed quite a while. We almost about an hour, and then we headed to Nagoya, which I think is the fourth largest city in Japan. And we booked ourselves into a backpackers. It's quite a big city. It's not really camping friendly. Got there, I wouldn't say relatively late, but again, slightly into the evening, and it was getting cold. And I just it was it's about 2 days since St. Patrick's Day, and I was like, Ron, I need to go and have a Guinness. Just for my friends, like that's something we did back home, and we said sweet, and we Googled an Irish bar, which wasn't too far, and we walked in there, and Hero, the owner of Langer's, welcomed us in, and he spoke great English. He's lived in Vancouver, in Cambodia, all around the world, and he runs this Irish bar now in Nagoya.
Self-proclaimed superhero.
Yes, yes, yes. And yeah, we just had, it was so cool. Like went into his cozy bar, and just relaxed a little bit, you know, time off, and just had cool conversations. He was sharing his story, we were sharing ours, taking photos, and yeah, what a good guy.
Yeah, and really just interesting as well from a guy who started his business. He always dreamt of owning an Irish bar and running an Irish bar. He'd worked with many around the world. And he launched it just before, he called it his COVID baby. I think he launched it a month or two before COVID arrived. And just hats off to the grit and determination to see it through. He did get some support from the government, from subsidies to sort of keep the doors open, so to speak. But very, very cool to see a guy who's just so happy. I think living a life true to himself, doing what he wants to be doing. Just loving having a bit of banter with people that, you know, that practicing his English, which is superb. And really just good to, as you say, just good to relax after what was actually a very cool day, but also quite a long day on the bike.
Yeah, it was. And just back to the generosity of human beings. Like he's been struggling with COVID, owning a bar. Yeah. And at the end, he spotted our bull for us. So what an absolute legend.
Yeah. Look forward. Yeah. Make sure you go and look out. We'll post in the show notes. We'll post the name of the bar there. But next time you're in Nagoya, please go and visit and have a Guinness there. It's fantastic.
Day 7 was a cool one for me, a milestone. It was relatively icy, but not too bad in the morning. But we did cycle towards the cold. Firstly, the one big highlight was a 4.1 kilometer tunnel that we had to cycle through. In a car, I don't know, maybe it goes by like in a flash, but on a bike, it is a long, long journey. And you have to be like very concentrated, make sure that, you know, you have good vis on yourself. And
you're also riding on a pavement, which is almost maybe 3/4 of a foot, you know, 30 centimeters high with no railing. And basically it's just wide enough for you and your bike with a pannier bag. So every now and then I find myself, my left elbow sort of hitting the wall, just being extra secure and making sure I was staying to the left. And you really felt like you were sort of cycling on a bridge, because the last you want to do is obviously come off on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
A, it's a big drop, and B, obviously cars thundering past you. So I actually found it exhausting. I think mentally as much as anything, just concentrating, sucking in the fumes.
The fumes was hectic. Yeah, 4 kilometers of car fumes.
but it was also a pleasant surprise, because this was the one day which we always highlighted and knew in the beginning of the trip was going to be the big climbing day. From Nagoya, you make your way over this big sort of range of mountains. There's no way around it. We did the same mountains in reverse from Osaka in 2019. We had a different route, but I remember the climb very well. And then as we got closer and closer to the summit, we looked on the maps and saw this particularly straight line. And a Komoot, which is the mapping app we use, doesn't distinguish between tunnels and roads. So quite luckily to come around the corner and there's a tunnel. It was 4 kilometers, quite hair-raising, but it did cut a lot of climbing off the top of the hill.
It was exciting. Yeah, our legs still in recovery mode from day 2 and 3. So we did respect the tunnel. I guess purist cyclists will say you should have gone over because there was an option left or right. But
we cycled it.
I think if I ever had to have a choice, I would never turn down a 4.1 kilometer tunnel. The experience was wild. I think going forward, I might go over, but it was really cool. And on the other side, we spotted snow, and it sounds ridiculous. I don't actually know how many countries I've traveled to, but it's about 20 or so. I've seen snow on mountaintops and that in the distance, but I've never touched it. And as we came out on the other side, there was just a whole lot of quite dirty mounds of snow, but I was stoked nonetheless, and I just went straight into it, grabbed a snowball, and just threw it somewhere. And it was quite a cool experience. You know, you don't get that often, and it was pretty epic.
Yeah, and I think it was also a reminder, it was quite chilly up there. So after a big push through the tunnel, I certainly was sweating, come out the other side. But it was also a very nice afternoon. So there was a snow lying around. Obviously, this is the final snow of the winter. And then quite a chilly descent down the hill
towards Lake Biwa, and I'm just gonna say it now because I have been getting it's either Biwa, Biqua, But on our Google and commute apps and whatever, we see B-I-W-E, Biwa.
Biwa, yeah.
So yeah, we headed basically from that tunnel downhill towards there, and it was getting a little bit cold. But we are quite excited because it's a massive lake and there's just camping spots all along.
I think it is, if not the biggest, certainly one of the biggest in Japan. It's enormous.
Yeah. And we had our eye on a few camping spots. Camping is always preferable. But in this cold weather, you kind of would prefer to find a place where you can get a warm shower with it. So yeah, we have no SCOM camping, but looking for a warm shower is always preferable because otherwise, you know, we finish the day and we have to rinse ourselves off with cold water in this freezing cold temperatures. So we found this campsite, I think it was called Miami. They had like really cool facilities, beautiful space. So yeah, we pulled in there. You pay a couple bucks to get a shower, which is worth it. And then we actually, to my quote, had one of the coldest nights of my life. yeah, it was freezing next to that water edge, but it was so beautiful.
And it was also cool seeing a couple of other cycle tourists, but this time motorcycle tourists, two Japanese guys, both on their very fancy touring bikes, obviously exploring their own country. And although we didn't share much conversation and we don't share much language, I think it was cool just to be sharing the same space with people also exploring Japan.
Yeah, Lake Biwa is a very special place. There's just something about the energy of that water. It was just amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, across the water, I mean, I think to explain a bit of the coldness, on the other side of the lake, there's these mountains which were covered in snow and the wind was absolutely howling from the mountain sides. So you had this icy wind coming down the mountains across the lake. The lake was very, very choppy and we were camping around the lake and I remember putting up our tent. Just what a mission it was, putting it up in the wind. So I think that icy, cold sort of dampness brought on by the wind really explains the chillness of the night.
But our dopamine got us up and ready to go for the next day, which was leading into Osaka. And it was quite exciting because there's the stop-start nature that we were used to in the big cities was going to slowly diminish in a way because there's a long cycling path that's dedicated specifically for cycling, no motorbikes, and I'll get onto that. All the way into Osaka and going there, there's fields on the left, right, there's this baseball and football. And then we saw a lot of rugby as well that we stopped and just took a break and watched the kids play. And, you know, we whipped out the whistle and the ball every once in a while, which created great excitement.
But sorry, just to interrupt, I mean, you've got these floodplains effectively, which run either side of the river. And for 20, 30 kilometers, as you say, but just the volume of sport happening on it was incredible. And obviously baseball being the dominant sport, a lot of football, a lot of rugby, as you say, but also various types of golf that I've never seen.
Oh, yes, yes,
like
yes.
Sand, mashy courses.
Putt-putt or something.
Yeah. But really, really just good to see people being outdoors and active and especially young people and young kids. We talk about all the time about how sad it is when you see kids just sort of stuck on the iPhones and things like that. But just see kids out there just having a jaw. It's just so cool.
You know, it is. The one thing about COVID are the masks. And, you know, every once in a while you would love to just have a bit of a smile. And the only way you can actually get that in Japan is, you know, at sports fields, the kids kind of take their masks off while they're practicing their sports. You can actually see it in onsens as well. We'll get to that. But it just brightens up your day. So it's really cool. And yeah, I enjoyed that. It's nice to have a cycle path. The one thing that I didn't enjoy is that to prevent people with their motorbikes riding on those paths, they have these, I don't even know what they're called, these like little barricades where a normal bicycle, fits through perfectly. You kind of just balance your pedals evenly and then, you know, you can just cruise slowly through it and carry on. But because we've got the two panniers on the back, they kind of don't fit in that. So you have to slow down completely, get off your bike and lift the 30 to 40 kilograms over it and then carry on, which is just...
it's absurd, basically.
It's absurd because, you know, I'll be fine every 10Ks, but these things were around maybe every kilometer.
Yeah, so you get it just... And then sometimes you think, oh, you're home free and you go 2 or 3 kilometers without one and then they come 2 or 3 within 100 meters as they're crossing a road. But nonetheless, I mean, it's still a very, very cool way. We did smash the kilometers down this river, not a a hill in sight. Mm. The weather was pretty cool.
Yeah, the weather was great.
And Osaka, yeah, as I say, I've only visited before during rugby, you know, well, the World Cup, and it was always a bit of a blur of buses and public transport and bars and rugby stadiums. But to actually be able to appreciate what, as Hiro, our previous guest on the podcast, his home city, and talked about it, and it is really well known as a very livable city, a lovely city, a big home of rugby. It was cool to be able to explore it on a bicycle. Yeah.
Great energy. And we kind of rolled in. We were meeting one of Ron's mates' parents-in-law. They were going to host us for the evening, but just before that, we stopped at this jazz bar. I'm going to call it that.
It was a jazz shot bar.
A jazz shot bar. You go in there, it's got every antique or weird
quirky
thing. We actually walked in and the owner was fast asleep on the table. And
in his tartan apron.
Yeah, we're watching some cartoons. Sort of cartoons. And yeah, he couldn't speak English, and we just said two beers, and he hooked us up. Got us a couple snacks. You know, we were just kind of getting a little bit warm before we had to navigate the lefts and rights of Osaka City to find our hosts for the evening. But yeah, that was a great experience.
Yeah, and great. Yeah, and Mike Robinson is an old friend of mine and old rugby coach of mine, lives in New York now. His wife, Yuko, who's obviously from Japan, and her parents live in Osaka. And he actually reached out, obviously, with the various time zones in the morning our time, which was still the evening in New York, saying, I see you guys on your way to Osaka. Make sure you look up Yuko's parents. I'd love to host you for the night. I said, Mike, well, be careful what you offer, because we're actually going to be arriving there this afternoon. And he connected us, and obviously certain language barriers in place. But through the wonders of modern communication, we got hold of Yuko's parents, found their house. And my goodness, it was like a homecoming. Never met them in our lives. And yet they treated us like their long-lost sons or prodigal sons returning home.
Yeah, it was such an interesting night because – seriously, we couldn't communicate. It was just all hand signals and gestures and smiles.
Yeah. Yuko's dad spoke one or two words of English. Yeah. And I think, girl, you were so very excited to tell us about the World Cup game you went to with Mike when they were out here getting married during the 2019 World Cup. So that in common, obviously, Mike, and how proud were they of their grandson who they've never met, Nelson.
Nelson, named after Nelson Mandela. I gave them a 10 rand note that has Nelson Mandela's face on it, a currency from South Africa, and they were super stoked. But yeah, it just, again, re-energizes us. We got to do some laundry. We got to sleep in a nice warm room. We ate thousands of pieces of sushi, and we had sake, and we just had an absolutely great evening.
Yeah, Mr. Gawa just had his 80th birthday recently. So he'd be given a bottle of sake for each decade. So he had eight bottles of sake and made sure we sampled them all.
Yeah.
So a very, very funny evening. And just the warmest, nicest family you can possibly imagine.
The next day we headed out of Osaka towards Kobe, where we would like to get a ferry crossing onto Awiji Island. And it was quite a wet morning. But yeah, cycling through the hustle and bustle of, I think it was it a Monday? No, it was a Tuesday. It was the first day that the COVID restrictions were kind of eased in Japan. Yeah. And there was a bit of a hustle and bustle, and we were going through some markets left and right, and it was cold. Our hands were freezing cold and wet, and we went past the bakery, and we kind of looked at each other like, the next one we see, we stop it for a hot croissant. And it just never really came. And then eventually we just like, okay, we'll pull into a convenience store and just heat one up. And it turned around and we saw a little shop with a grumpy pig on the door. And I squinted my eyes and I kind of saw a whole lot of pastries and breads and stuff through the window. I was like, Ron, that's our spot. Just stumbled in there, walked in, was greeted by a lady called Risa. And then out of the kitchen comes a guy called Graham, and he just says, how's it? Which is a very South African term of hello. Graham's a fellow South African, been living in Japan for years, hasn't been home for a long time, but yes, he was excited to hear our accents, come into his shop. And yeah, we just got chatting, and it was amazing. It was just out of nowhere.
I think just the serendipity and just the coincidence of it all, because he was working in his kitchen, caught a glimpse of our bikes, which have South African flags on the bike. We happened to stop there, happened to see the sign. And initially, you might think it's a Chinese restaurant or a quirky little bar. But as you say, you looked through the window and saw the pastries there and walked in. I don't know who was more surprised to see who.
Yeah. And they treated us. They actually, again, like the generosity of human beings, they refused for us to pay for our pies, and we sat and chatted to Graham for a long time, just catching up, and I think he enjoyed having a flowing South African conversation, you know, catching up with the different quotes and banter that South Africans have. And it was an amazing experience, and we kept in contact with them, and, you know, I'll get into the post that soon, but yeah, what great people.
But also a guy who's, you know, spent about the last 20, 30 years of his career working in the hospitality industry all around Asia, spent a lot of time in Jakarta and other parts of Indonesia and Malaysia, Hong Kong. And 2 or 3 years ago also decided that he was over the corporate world and wanted to go and do his own thing and found this little bakery. He'd met his wife 20, 30 years ago somewhere in on his travels and his working world. So him and his wife and their two young sons, yeah, who sort of 19 and 20, opened up this bakery, again, just before COVID. And, you know, he's trying to sell pies in a country that doesn't really recognize them. If you're trying to sell pies in New Zealand or Australia or South Africa or the UK, you know, it's a good market. People understand it. But trying to introduce pies into Japan, it's very, very cool. And he said it's growing slowly and the local community are trying them and enjoying them. And again, just a sign of, I just love the resilience of it and, someone just going off and living their dream and making it happen. It's really, very, very inspiring.
Yeah, it was very cool. We then headed from Grumpy Kitchen is what their shop's actually called, towards Kobe, and we got onto a ferry, our first of many ferries, where we had to board a ferry. There's a massive suspension bridge that connects Kobe to Awiji Island, the island that we're on at the moment, but you can't cycle across it, so you have to either – actually, you can only take a ferry. Yeah. So you grab this ferry – runs every 15 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever it is. And yeah, we loaded our bikes onto the ferry and we took a 15-minute crossing and we went under this beautiful, mesmerizing suspension bridge. This is something about massive things that are just like, yeah, you know, big buildings, big mountains, this big bridge. You just can't, you just stare at it for the whole 15 minutes.
Yeah, like, wow. Picture the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, and which is obviously iconic and golden. This is a silver version of that and much longer. It's one of the longest suspension bridges in the world. And when you cycle, you're on the back of the ferry, going underneath it, and it was a wonderfully beautiful afternoon, clear skies. Mm. It really was very special.
No, it was a cool experience, very cool. We didn't include those kilometers on our Strava, so don't worry. But yeah, we got to the other side and basically rolled off the ferry. And Ouija Island is known for its like circumnavigation of the island, I think. You can do like a 60-kilometer one-way route and then a 60-kilometer back is that kind of what tourists would usually do. So it was heading into the evening. We had some campsites in mind. We do have some miscommunication with campsites because sometimes on the internet, camping doesn't mean our term camping where you can like set up a tent and sleep there for the night. Sometimes camping means you go and camp there for the day with your gazebo and you could just hang out. But yeah, nonetheless, we found.
And again, it's also out of season as well. I think a lot of campsites that are traditional campsites are just closed and shut it up as well.
Yeah, and we found this place. It's called the Wellness Center or Wellness Park. I think during summer, this is a hot hit. Although there are quite a few children running around now as we're chatting, and there's a couple camper vans set up, and they have an onsen, like a more commercial onsen that we went to both nights. It's the only place you can shower. And it was pretty packed. So yeah, I think it's a very cool, relaxed spot. It makes sleeping a lot easier knowing that, you know, you won't be bugged by some local police officer for camping in a place that might be spiritual or forbidden or not allowed. But yeah.
Yeah, so I think as well as it was, I mean, we was talk about the ride down, you know, it was about 25 Ks or 30 Ks from the ferry terminal where we jumped off the ferry and cycled down here. It was sunset, and I mean, there were a couple of blogs I'd read and just sort of reviews about the island and just some ideas about the route all talked about the sunset. So we just absolutely nailed it in terms of the time of the day and just having a lovely afternoon. So classic sunsets on our right. Some memories, I guess, of Windhoek or of Namibia, just with the water. And there's some really, like, you can imagine, you know, from South Africa, we have this strip called Camps Bay in Cape Town, which is, you know, also has this very famous sort of sunset settling, you know, coming down in the West, and these sort of all fancy restaurants and bars, and a lot of that sort of scene here.
Yes.
And again, in the summer, you can imagine it just absolutely buzzing.
Yeah.
But we felt, yeah, like we had it to ourselves. And that, you know, it's very cycling friendly. The road, people obviously used to having cyclists there. And we, frankly, that's probably the fastest 25, 30Ks I think we've done since we started here in Japan.
It got us over 100 kilometers because, you know, we weren't expecting to do 100.
Yeah.
And just the ease of cycling on the road, just we're just like, well, we just keep going.
Had energy, seemed to have, I think we're just the high on life, as they say. Just gave, we had the energy in our legs and before we found this camping spot.
Yeah. In the evening after our onsen and saunas and so on and set up the tent, unfortunately, we got a message back from home that the process for getting my, with the South African passport visa, is
Vietnam.
For Vietnam is a bit unclear. So, you know, we were guided by the information we had previously. It just kind of hasn't really been distributed across the world, as there's nothing really else to say about it. And so essentially we had to change to plan B on acquiring a visa for Vietnam. And the best option for that was for me to wake up early in the morning and grab a bus and a couple trains back to Osaka and go and visit the consulate in Osaka, the Vietnam consulate, and just really sit with someone official and work out exactly what is the minimum requirements that I need to get into Vietnam, because the updated protocols only actually work for 13 countries in the world and not how we thought.
Yeah, and I think others. To give a bit of context, like a lot of countries in the Asia Pacific, Vietnam has been closed to tourists for 2 years now, effectively. And just like Japan, it was quite onerous to get a visa here. We were very uplifted by the news that as of the 15th of March, which was last week, that we would be able to, it's tourism resuming as normal was the headline. And all indications was that that's exactly what would be happening and all the old rules would apply. Whereas a South African, all you need to do is straightforward, get a visa, hand in a form, pay your $25 and you get a tourist visa. And that's kind of what we're relying on doing in South Africa. Fumi from Japan Rugby had actually gone to the Japanese embassy before the 15th of March.
The Vietnamese embassy in Tokyo
to apply for visas on our behalf. And we were confident that because we were traveling after the 15th of March, the visa, there'll be no problem. And she was informed at the time that you need this official letter of invitation. And we kind of put that down to the fact that it was, as I say, it was before the 15th. So reapplying after the 15th, Kath, our base camp manager in South Africa, has been liaising with the embassy in Pretoria, who've been very helpful and doing what they can to keep her informed and to promise to process that as soon as the new rules kick in. But thankfully, you made the decision to go to Osaka, because only when you actually sat with an official who could explain the exact situation, and he explained it that no, it's returning to normal, tourism is returning to normal Vietnam, just for those countries that have visa exemptions. So the US, the UK, Japan, et cetera. But unfortunately, South Africa doesn't fit under that.
Yeah. And we were also surprised the information in South Africa, they weren't actually aware that was the case for them either. Yeah. So, you know, we were confident we were going to get it. But nonetheless, I went there, got all the information. We've made connections and contacts with DHL and Child Fund Rugby based in Hanoi. And yeah, we're just pulling all the strings and everyone's getting together to try and help me get this letter. And once I have the letter, the process is quite straightforward. That was the day off yesterday. And
yeah, I just want to say as well, and this is not an advert for DHL, but Tony Khan, who's the country manager here in Japan, I've known him for a long time. Picked up the phone and said, "Tony, we're in trouble. We need this letter." Literally within minutes, we had an email to his counterpart in Vietnam, who'd emailed also his counterpart in Thailand, who'd emailed his counterpart in Vietnam saying, "We're onto it." His PA, Rosie, got hold of you an hour or two later. So it's just, you know, incredible to have, you know, like a lot of things in life, you need the right people around you. So it looks like we will be able to get that letter soon.
Yeah. And, That brings us to right now where we're sitting. We woke up this morning, a little relaxed evening. We don't need to get up early because another crossing is on its path. But this next crossing requires us to get on a bus. You can't cycle across the bridge, but you can only take a bus, and the bus is only at 12 o'clock. So we decided to record this podcast and just have an easy morning. And in the next 3 to 4 seconds, we're going to wrap it up and get on our bikes and keep going.
Yeah, we're pretty much packed, ready to go. I'm delighted that the sun's out. I think I've actually been a little bit overdressed, got the tights back on. And just, yeah, just a bit of clarification, Owaji, obviously the island we're on now, to get to Sokoko Island, and I probably butchered the pronunciation, there's another long suspension bridge. And unfortunately, there's no ferry option. So it's a bit of a convoluted process. Again, James McGee, our American friend in Tokyo, him and one of his Japanese colleagues have actually booked the bus for us. It's a bit annoying because you get there, you have to take your wheels off and drop your saddle. But it's all part of the fun of adventuring. We'll cross the bridge. We'll hopefully be the other side, sort of 12:30, and then start cycling south along Sokoko Island, which is probably, for me, the part of the trip that I'm looking forward to as much as anything in Japan. And we've been told to look out for some whirlpools that are very famous that run underneath this bridge that we're crossing just now. So yeah, about 25 Ks, it's 9:45. I think we should wrap this up. And just once again, we haven't even spoken about it, but I think we're at about $3,500 that we've raised for Child Fund Rugby. We are so grateful to everyone that's donated online. We're so grateful to everyone that's bought kilometers. And I think once we reach Hanoi and we start cycling south through Cambodia and Thailand, and we'll talk about, you know, the route options and discussions through Southeast Asia, we're going to have a pretty much unbroken run to Timor-Leste and Darwin and Sydney. And then it's going to be a really big focus for us is to push out these kilometers, get people to sign up, get people to buy the kilometers. And for those that have, thank you so much.
Thanks. Let's get going.
See you next week on the Race Rugby World Cup Pod.